Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Really, WSM.
Right, the cat. It's the weirdest technique I've ever seen. I don't know. It's the shot of it. It's like he's is it left footed? I think it's like the outside of his foot. Mm. I mean, as a football technique, this is all wrong. I mean, I don't really know what he's going for. Is he trying to flick it into Blofeld's? Why is he? Or is that a coincidence that jumps up to Blofeld? I love it. What's going on?
There's an amazing production photo on Thunderballs of that being shot.
Where was it shot?
And Charles Gray pretending to die at the same time as holding on to what I hope at least is a stuffed cat. It's so good. It's
such a dramatic, like,
because it is,
you know, spreading out the arms. And...
He's kicking the cat to see who it goes.
Right. Okay.
So if it goes to the it's supposed to go to the real Blofeld. That's what how I always read that scene. Is he kicks the cat and it should run to the real Blofeld. Therefore, he should.
Really? Yeah. That's.
I've never thought that ever.
No, I've always thought that, Chris.
Oh right. Because I was just thinking.
Right. Man. Another essay.
So would a cat have much choice?
But then I don't think cats would go.
They're not like that. Cats, are they? No.
I was going to say, am I the only one who owns cats? No, has anyone else got cats? Oh, you got a cat. So if I was to, obviously, you know, this is purely hypothetical, and animal cruelty
I know what you're
is
gonna
of
say
course
now.
Wrong. If anyone from if you were to kick a cat, would it be able to move? Would it be able to change trajectory in the air to go to its preferred
flight? You know, in the middle.
What?
I've got to say, guys, of all the loopholes that this film has, this was not the one that I thought we'd be discussing.
Right idea, Mr. Bond. Wrong pussy.
Wrong pussy. I've never thought that, but next time I watch it, I'm going to think, is the cat kind of manoeuvring its way to a safe haven? Is that what it's trying to do?
I was rewinding the technique of kicking so much that I completely forgotten the rest of the flying and who's going to...
Now,
what is going on?
That's one of the things I love about Blofeld. It is the cats. I recently recorded with Jack Lugo a podcast where I tried to impersonate Charles Gray. And the only idea I could think of to kind of make it funny is because my voice is nothing like Charles Gray's, apart from being English, and I can kind of stick on a sort of RP upper class sort of accent if I need to. I thought the funniest thing would be to just play up the fact that Blofeld is a massive, like, cat dad. Just the whole thing about him being obsessed with cats, and, you know, even to the point of the way that he gets people to sign on to being his doubles, which, let's face it, is a dangerous occupation, is to promise them a lifetime supply of cats. That's the only reason they've got to do
it. Is that the first time there was another cat's revealed then, to show that? So the whole kicking to catch the cat might be right still. It did go to its owner, but the actual Blofeld's cat is the other cat. It's yet to. So much thought has gone into the script, hasn't it? My word. Incredible script writing. And it's got a diamond necklace, so it must be. And that's the link with the solar ending, isn't it? The missiles. Mm-hmm. No.
Which is obviously the diamond necklace is nice little reference to that. Oh, yeah. To kill with you.
Oh. Didn't you know diamonds are a girl's best friend?
It's like Lupe was in the room.
It's like Lupe was just line reading. Can you just do that again, love, please? Anyway, the extended theme now is lovely as it's going on. It's like a twinkly version. Then we get the first, is it the first sign of the cassette? This cassette we're obsessed with. In a like really elaborate safe that he puts it in.
You see the cassette earlier at the lab, obviously, and then you see the same. Yeah. So I always think it's quite a neat MacGuffin, actually. They don't make that much of it, but it definitely does its job. You know, sometimes when you watch, I don't know about you, but when you watch the Marvel movies, sometimes it's like, it's a big glowing blue orb thing that we're going to follow for the next 2.5 hours and we don't really care about it. But it's this really naff little cassette tape. But it sort of fits.
Because it works, isn't it? Because that's the one thing that the sort of plot revolves around. It's just, like I say, it's almost more, it's much more charming, isn't it? A little cassette tape with a brass band on, military band on the cover.
Yeah.
But yeah, that vault is amazing. I think that's where, you know, Ken Adams really firing on all cylinders there.
He's good at vaults, isn't he? The one in You Only Live Twice, one of my favourite scenes with the, you know, when he's trying to undo it, the steps in the background.
Ooh, yeah.
And one of the best fights ever. Yeah. People seem to have, you know, don't really rate as highly as they should. Was it The Rock's? The Rock's granddad or something? Yeah, that's amazing.
Rock's granddad.
Yeah. But yeah, Ken Adam, glorious, really, again. Blofeld then puts him into the lift, and obviously he's anticipating what's going to happen next. A bit like Spy Love Me, with the receptionist or whatever drops down his.
But weirdly,
no, exactly,
that hasn't happened yet. This is what was always weird, because I think I saw The Spy Love Me before Diamonds Are Forever, so I always thought, oh, it's because he knows that Strong
Boy. It's not happened.
But hang on, no. We haven't had a lift with the disappearing floor in a Bond film yet.
It's a bit like the scene in Temple of Doom where he goes for his gun when they're attacking him, which is a reference to the film, which is set after where he is, so that's...
You
can't expect that, because it's not actually happened yet, because it's like 4 years before.
Fair point.
You know, like in... It might have been a George Lucas thing, but didn't they sort of... Well, I remember when the young Indiana Jones came out, they gave them a year each episode, and they put... I think they put Raiders after the Temple of Doom in the chronology. Well, they changed them in the actual dating of it.
What?
Again, I must have to look at this up, but... No. Maybe it was for some kind of continuity error like that. Who knows?
But I thought the reasoning that Temple of Doom is set before Raiders is because they didn't want Indiana Jones to be cheating on Marion.
Right. Okay.
Because obviously they got together again.
It is.
That's a very Bondian thing, isn't it? The whole monogamous main character. I mean, obviously, you know, I'm sure you guys know about, you know, the whole history of Indiana Jones, because they couldn't do a Bond film, so they went and did that. Instead.
Exactly.
But also, if just at risk of going off into a massive tangent, because I love the Indiana Jones films as well, but you know, Indiana Jones is a different character in a way in Temple of Doom. He goes from fortune and glory to, you know, seeing the greater good, and that's the character we have at the start of Raiders of the Lost Ark. So his character arc sets up Raiders of the Lost Ark, and that's why that film is so good. Raiders of the Lost Ark is amazing. Temple of Doom is so good too, because it's got that great character arc, and it also allows you to do some darker things with the character.
It's not a deliberate prequel, is it? It's not.
No.
It was set the year.
35.
I just mean 35, it's not,
but yeah, but it's not like this is the people. Yeah. Yes. Well, yeah.
Although now you've said that, Tom. Now you've said that, Tom. Maybe it was sort of like Indiana Jones Begins.
So Lucas was doing it back then, but it's even before Star Wars.
Yeah,
but
maybe.
But it's done. It's done in a less obvious way. It's more subtle.
Yeah.
The mission is still the main point. You know, there is character development in Indiana Jones, but there is still the focus of the mission. Not the problem, but the trend with anthology stories now in terms of doing Bond Begins, Batman Begins, whatever you like, focus is the character of the title, you know, the title character. So I do think there is a slight difference between the two, personally.
Well, it's just a great film.
I'm now trying to think of a link to get us back into Dark.
The lift, it was the lift.
I can't.
The lift.
Oh, the lift, that's it.
Or shall I say elevator? Yes.
Yeah.
Or shall I say elevator?
Nice.
There's a weird relationship with Bond films and American vocabulary. So I love the Brosnan era, but it's very noticeable that he uses a lot of Americanisms. For presumably to kind of appease the American market. And that does sort of irk me. But I like the way that they play with it here. And obviously we've talked about this already, but Mankiewicz was an American writing in a British idiom. So it's quite fun that he's playing around with... it is almost like a shade at the American language. So, of American English, really, or perhaps I should say elevator.
Yeah,
the way he delivers it, he's like caustic.
Is he meant to be English, Blofeld? But anyway, he is for the purposes of this film.
I can't even. Yeah, in the novel, I can't even remember his nationality. But
that's what I always assume.
Bruges. Yeah.
Daddy's from Bruges. So yes, you think that he's going to fall through the bottom of the lift elevator. But that's actually, you know, a ruse, isn't it? Because he's gassed instead when he gets to the bottom. Which is, again, another of his kids. It's quite harrowing, quite scary.
Mm.
And then, like you say, because Blofeld, Wint and Kidd, they never the twain shall meet. They sort of just appear, don't they? That, I suppose, is the first proper link we've got between them and Blofeld, that they're ready and waiting to do his bidding. Is that right?
It's the only link.
Yeah.
You do get the sense that Blofeld doesn't really know what's going to happen next.
Yeah, just...
It's like, I'll get rid of Bond, and they can play around with him. You know, play with him for a few hours, and maybe Bond will survive, maybe he won't. You know, I mean, you could literally just shoot him in the head, obviously, but where would be the fun in that?
Austin Powers.
And that's obviously something... Exactly, that's something...
Just shoot
him in the head. I have burned it in my room. Just shoot him! So it is like he's playing this cat and mouse game with Bond the whole way through. He's just playing with Bond like a cat plays with its toy, just seeing whether it's going to survive a little bit longer or not. He's not that frustrated when Bond reappears alive later on. He's almost sort of relieved.
There's something a bit more interesting. Because at the end, of course, which we'll go into more depth, but he's complete calm, isn't he, Blofeld? While Metz is absolutely... the opposite, isn't he? So he's almost quite maybe amused that this will annoy Metz, the fact that Bond's
stop Metz, I'll have you shot.
Another
prepare my
bathers up. I'm out of here.
Actual stage version, he would have to be waiting around for ages before he had to come back. But
what bathos up panel number two?
The other thing is, when I was thinking about this film the other day, it's always been there. What does this film remind me of? And I've come to the conclusion it reminds me of the 1960s
TV
series.
Yeah.
In terms of the campness, but in terms of just, it very has that feel. No more so when Wint and Kidd drive through essentially a back cave to come out the other side, like into the desert. It just, when I watched that, I was like, oh my word, that is absolutely just the same as when Adam West did it through Green Manor in the
tunnel. Could have been going on for miles and miles. Series. Presumably, how cool is that? I mean,
definitely.
Long secret road that they've got. Again, I don't know whether Canon does all that, but the, like the cactus being lifted or whatever, it's for them to get out.
This is
Then we get another, you know, the darlings having finishing each other's sentences again. Famous. Does anyone want to practice?
Prompt us. It's like we're doing Amtram, darling.
It's Mr. Winton.
Prompt us.
It always is. Yeah. If at first you don't succeed, Mr. Kidd.
Correct. Try again, Mr. Wind.
Very romantic. Oh.
Yeah, the music. Sorry, to keep harping on about the music. It's really sinister, the music, as they're going through the tunnel and everything. It's so good.
No, I love it. It's a very odd way to leave it. I mean, it's ripe for taking the mick, isn't it? What earth is the plan? That it becomes sci-fi, doesn't it, Bruce?
You say that. I mean, if we're talking about phobias, you know, we've had John's heights. I am quite claustrophobic. I'm not exactly. And we talked about the coffin, but this is like my worst nightmare.
Buried Alive
Part 2.
I always link it as well to. I'll mention this film in every single episode, but Superman 3 again.
I really need to prioritise rewatching Superman 3, clearly. Is that the one with Richard Pryor?
It's like Diamonds, because it's...
Yeah, I remember liking that one as a kid.
And it's really tongue-in-cheek, and you've got Richard Pryor, and then the other half is easily the darkest Superman, when he's fighting himself. But it doesn't get better, honestly.
Oh, I remember.
People always just say 1 and 2, and then the rest are rubbish. No, 1 and 3, and then the other one's rubbish.
Diamonds are Forever is the Superman 3 of the Bond series.
But we need more people to see the third one. But it reminds me of that, just because he's abandoned Clark Kent. He knocks Clark Kent, the evil Superman, and puts him in this... Oh, it's like a car, you know, where they go and crush cars. It's awful. And he's trapped in that, and the howls are... children watching that. But it always reminds me that I was terrified Bond was put in this pipe, and I don't know what's going to happen to him. He's like lowered in, isn't he, still? And the diggers are there as well.
So, are the people building the pipeline?
Is this to do with the plot?
Do they work for Willard White? Because they're really surprised, obviously, when he escapes, he comes out. The workmen are really surprised to see him walking my rat for a walk, and I lost my way.
I was out walking my rat.
Like, they don't know you've just seen a rat. It only works for the audience.
I mean, you've obviously in the actual pipeline as well. You've got that bit that the twine references with the kind of electric thing that comes, and I love when he looks at it. He lies down forward, looks at it, and he does this gorgeous like cross of his legs when he does it. It's just the crispest cross when he amazing, amazing.
He's just talking to himself, isn't he? Throughout that. Yeah, so it's
going to a rat.
One of us smells like a tart.
I'm afraid one of us smells like a tart's handkerchief. I'm afraid it appears to be me, old boy.
Not me, old boy.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah, I've used that line so. Like one of those everyday Bond lines.
Yeah.
Whenever I don't put on aftershave or whatever every day, just because, you know, I can't be bothered. But if I do, I'm just like, one of us smells like a tart's handkerchief.
He's just enjoying it so much.
He's loving it.
He really is. Yeah. He's just having such a fun time.
It's superb. There's more Barry music, which make it a little bit more scary and exciting. Yeah, that machine, I was scared of that machine. I was terrified of getting electrocuted. And I don't know. It doesn't last long as you like short circuit it and jumps on it. And yeah, obviously twine, yeah, like I say, was a nod to that. As if. Well. Yeah, and then the miners release it. I love it. Brilliant.
Willard White speaking. If you're enjoying Really 007, why not follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram? Look us up at Really 007 Pod, even if you're from Baja. Bert Saxby, tell him it's fine.
The next scene is another scene with somebody on the phone. This time it's Blofeld, but it's, of course, Bond posing as Saxby to Blofeld. That's correct, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And it is another... You don't think of this film as the most gadget-heavy, but this is another type of gadget, isn't it, from Q, which he's quite proud of. Yeah, so it's a machine that alters your voice and makes you sound like somebody else, which, again, is a bit Batman, the 60s series.
Yeah. I mean, I really like this scene.
Another one.
it gives a bit of character background to Q as well. Yeah, it gives the inference that he made it for the children for Christmas. It kind of gives the slight inference that Q's a family man. Which is
He mentions he's got kids, doesn't he?
Is it? I missed this.
It's the
the ring.
Yeah, he does. Not something when Bond says ingenious Q. Oh, not at all. I made one for the kids last Christmas. It's the only time we get any personal information about Q.
Yeah, it is.
And I mean, famously, Desmond Llewellyn said that he tried to give some characterization to Q by the different ties that he wore. So he always got to choose the tie that Q was wearing. Oh, so he created this entire... It's so sweet, bless. He created this entire backstory for Q. Oh. And the ties were designed to kind of tell that story, like his cricket club and the school he went to and all that kind of stuff.
I have never studied.
I know that there is a Bond Instagram and Twitter account for everything, and there are people who do specialise in ties. So perhaps they're the sort of people to ask about.
You're the fun and bow tie experts, aren't you, sir? Our resident expert.
I like bow ties. That's about the extent of my tie knowledge. I know how to tie one kind of knot in a tie, and a bow tie, so two. So that's literally the extent of my knowledge. But what I find really interesting is that Q has created the same gadget that Blofeld has.
So there's a leak.
They've both got this voice changing. It's almost like a little bit of a Cold War.
And
obviously this film is, you know, imbued a lot of Cold War. The bad guys and the good guys are trying to outdo each other with the technology. And I know it's a really silly one, but actually being able to change your voice is quite a cool spy idea, isn't it? Yeah.
You'd argue that Q's beat Blofeld because Sean Connery can speak like Bert Saxby without speaking at the side of his mouth like Blofeld. I said,
he does, doesn't he, for that scene, yeah. Again, that's to show that it's not really him. We can tie this in to from ties to the tie because this is the first time Bond is wearing the white shirt and the pink tie. There you
go. Horses. I almost wore that today to work, but it's Jim Fanning Friday, so I couldn't do it, really. It's not a bow tie, but, that pink tie combo.
Lovely.
Well, I think it's pretty fair to say, like, Diamonds Are Forever itself, it's divisive, that pink tie look.
Yeah, I don't know. It probably is, but the kind of circles we
there are some people, trust me. Well, I know John, with the first recording session we did of this, 73 years ago.
You mean 20 hours weren't done straight, in one go?
Yeah, this 20-hour podcast. But the first recording session, John did it, and then I've lost track. But the second or the third, I wore it. It is such an iconic look. There are some Bond fans who absolutely, and in fact, I've seen a few articles on fashion websites. Not that they ever know anything, but I've seen a few articles which decry this as a low ebb for Bond fashion. You can't help but think that it's... I wouldn't go so far as to say it's homophobia, but it's definitely that fragile masculinity of, men can't wear pink. Mm. And somehow Connery wearing pink emasculates him.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that Connery has worn pink in almost every Bond film to date... By this point, he wears pink shirts in You Only Live Twice, most famously. He wears pink in Thunderball.
Yeah.
I'm sure he wears pink in some of the others as well. It's his colour, and he wears the baby blue and he wears the pink, and he wears both really, really well. And that's what I think is so great about Connery in the role. Is that he kind of embodies both the masculine... It was actually Susan Sontag when she was writing about camp. I found a really great quote, which kind of, for me, epitomised Sean Connery. She said, there's something really attractive about someone when they have the qualities of both masculine and feminine. So there's something really attractive about a man when they have certain feminine qualities. And she didn't kind of specify anything more. But Connery has a lot of feminine qualities to his portrayal of Bond, And whether, you know, the colour, you know, whether that counts as feminine or not, you know, colour kind of associations are sort of arbitrary anyway. But, yeah, so I just think it's actually a really strong look. Wearing a crisp white shirt, crisp is definitely the word of the day.
Word of our lives, sorry.
I've never used that word before today in that sense, and now I'm going to use it all the time. It's catching. So, very crisp white shirt. And that bold, and it is a bold pink. It's not demure at all. And he carries it off with such nonchalance. It's so good.
Do you imagine that he's wearing it partly because he's in Vegas and it's quite hot and he's obviously not going to... He holds his jacket later, doesn't he? But
yeah. Yeah, I think,
100%.
Yeah, and he doesn't do up his tie, does he?
Yeah, is his top button undone?
Mm-hmm.
This is really going to...
It'd just look a bit weird if he was wearing a three-piece suit.
Yeah.
Especially a black three-piece suit in like the baking heat of Nevada, it just wouldn't look right.
Yeah, and you couldn't imagine him like in Thunderball, you know, in those kind of those almost like they're not quite Hawaiian shirts, but there's a much more relaxed kind of shirt. Yeah. It wouldn't look right in Vegas. He'd look too.
Yeah, he's a spy.
Casual.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he's a great look. I think he's.
I'm all.
Like we were saying before about like with the you know the black shirt and then later on with the turtleneck and that brown jacket. There's some great outfits in this, and you always think that oh well, the 70s. You sort of laugh at, you know, you start getting into you know the more area of safari suits and
always looks good,
you
know, to me.
Massive flares and things, but actually it looks really crisp.
Yeah. Chris. Well,
that is the correct use of the term. Yeah. But Bond's always meant to be, you know, wearing what's appropriate. Sometimes he needs to settle in and look how he would look if he was trying to blend in. A bit like if you go to a stables, you would wear, you know, a velour tracksuit. That's what you would do, isn't it?
It's the done thing.
So he reveals the location of the real Willard White, and Blofeld lets him go to kill White, so Saxby's ordered to go there, and of course he's not the real Saxby. It's getting confusing just talking about it. And the real Blofeld then tells Metz, so Metz is that the plans have been moved forward 24 hours. We don't really know what they are though yet, do we?
No, it's sort of view to a killish in a way. You really don't know the end game until really late in the day.
So
the threat is constantly delayed.
It's how to do it.
And then when the end game actually appears, it's so outlandish. It's so amazing. We'll get to that in a bit, though.
Giving nothing away.
This is where we're all going to fall out.
So well said.
Because I, you know, we've gone so far towards converting John to like this is where the wheels come off.
But I think it's gone up a couple of rungs. Maybe he's appreciated more already. I think
I've really appreciated this film.
Good,
yeah, lots to
good.
It's one of the lines that isn't really a cutting remark of Blofeld's, but I love Charles Gray's delivery when he says, "Never mind, James Bond."
Yeah,
it's like just put it. I'll deal with him. Never mind, James Bond. It's like he's stealing my limelight. Why do you keep talking about James Bond? And there's something so egomaniacal about Bond talking about himself on the phone as this big threat.
And then
Blofeld does sort of put him down, going, "Never mind, just like get it out the way." Yeah,
it's like if he's half the genius they say he is,
yeah,
the real trouble. It's like I love the fact he's always bigging himself up.
Yeah, it's great. It is great for another good, underrated scene. It gets forgotten.
Mm.
So then another Ken Adam is, you know, best again, I assume. I mean, unless it is an actual, well, the exterior.
Oh, the house.
The house.
It was real, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure
it's a real house. Right, okay.
Elrod House.
Yeah.
It's
amazing.
In fact, bit of brutal.
Yeah, I've got it here. I should have read my notes, but it's been so long ago. The Elrod House, designed by John Lautner. So, is that the interior though as well?
I think the interior is this map. I think it wasn't a set. I don't think,
including the pool and all that. Amazing. So this is, well, it's a house, isn't it? That Willard White is prisoner at, but doesn't seem to be tied up or anything. I mean, it's a, like a free prison. But
he's like in the like the granny.
Yeah, yeah. He's got his own little. I don't you know. Are the guards Bambi and Thumper, or are they just there at the time, or?
Well, this is one of the curiosities of this film. One of the many things that makes me go, oh, just go with it. It's Diamonds Are Forever.
Yeah, yeah.
But they are in Willard White's employ, clearly, from what he says later on. I see you've met my friends Bambi and Thumper. But I always, when you watch, if you were to watch this film for the first time not knowing that, you'd think they are more of Blofeld's hench people, who are sort of simultaneously guarding White. Yeah. And keeping him prisoner. It's a little bit... It's like, how is Willard White actually kept prisoner? Because he could just walk out, couldn't he?
Well, but they shoot a lock off the door.
Yes.
So
I suppose so.
So there is some element of being kept prison.
Yeah, or the fact that Willard White has maybe had a run-in with Bambi and Thumper, so he like as if he knows what they're like, you know.
More links to circus, you know, those stage names, acrobats and Vegas, isn't it?
So. Named after Disney characters.
Yeah.
I don't know how they got away with it, to be honest, because Disney are obviously famously litigious about their intellectual property. I suppose you could argue Bambi and Thumper are so well known that you can't really copyright those.
Like the 30s, was it? Yeah, still.
Yeah, can you imagine? Gosh.
And the fight, I love how, I suppose it is really theatrical, where every move, it's like there's like, she one of them will do some sort of slight karate move, which sort of almost falls into sort of interpretive dancing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then moves really quickly, then pauses.
Oh.
And then attacks. It's such a strange, like, almost a bit like a dream sequence.
Before we get that, just a mention that the walking entrance from Bond with the jacket over his shoulder and the amazing version of the Bond theme on the electric guitar.
Oh my God, this might be my actual favourite version of the Bond theme. This is the one that I always hear in my head when I try to nonchalantly walk somewhere that I've never been before. It's that I want to own this space sort of thing. I feel more confident than I really am. It's that version of the theme tune that plays. It's so sublime.
So crisp, isn't it?
So crisp.
If you did, I think someone put it on Twitter recently, just that little few seconds, and it's like, how Bond... just in those moments and the swagger of Connery. I love it. Felix, of course, and his goons are outside waiting in the cars, aren't they? Because Bond's obviously going his bait. Yeah, they're not credited, Bambi and Thumper. Uncredited,
really?
Yeah.
What? Yeah. That's mad.
Lola Larson and Trina Parks. I think they changed actress.
Trina Parks has appeared on quite a few online events in the last few years.
Here's hoping, yeah. Another shout out. please come on our podcast, yeah.
Come.
Does Bond, he goes in there expecting to have sex? That's what I've written down.
Yeah, that's what I take it as.
No?
Well, maybe not sex. Maybe I've just...
He thought he could charm his way past.
I've
jumped the gun a bit there, sorry.
And then she knees him in the nuts, so...
Which is obviously, you know, it's the whole, no, you're not going to get through us by seducing us. And there's definitely some queer coding going on with these characters as well. They've definitely got some sort of... there's intimations of some sort of sapphic sort of connection between the two of them, I think.
Yawn again, Bambi!
Yeah, yawn again, Bambi! It's like they're finishing each other's sentences sort of thing. A bit like Wint and Kid do.
Have anyone ever seen them as a couple? Or I've never really heard much of them.
I haven't... I do need some more kind of lesbian perspective on Bond because of some of the kind of lesbian contributors on the site that I've asked a couple of them about Bambi and Thumper, and they've said they've never really kind of seen that themselves, so I don't know, maybe it's kind of a male projection, some kind of fantasy, I don't know.
Thought they were like friends through work, you know, like they were a double act, you know.
Yeah, we met at work, yeah. I
always thought they were circus performers. The way that she swings from the ceiling.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
So I always thought they were by day they work in the circus. By night,
like,
the bodyguards,
like the twins
or henchwomen.
So
yes.
Is this the first time we've had physical female adversaries?
Yeah.
They're quite groundbreaking.
Yeah.
And of course, the first black villain.
And it's obviously a female. There is lots and lots of stuff going on, and for 9/10 of their screen time, it comes across brilliantly.
Oh, heck.
And unfortunately, to me, it really bombs that it just finishes with after they have absolutely laid the smack down on Bond. Bond's not.
It is wrestling, actually, isn't it? It's like a wrestling match.
Yeah. And in the end, they do what every 10-year-old does to their brother and sister when they go on holiday, and he just dunks them under the water. And it's such a dismissive way to finish them, I think.
And they sort of tap out, don't they? Like wrestling, almost like, yeah.
Yeah.
It's absolutely, yeah.
Sorry, I don't want to rain
no.
the parade. It's
no, no, I think it's a legitimate criticism, definitely. But I think the reason I like this scene is because Bond is shown to be sort of ridiculous in a way. My favourite shot of this scene is where he crashes through the glass coffee table.
Yeah.
There's something very slapstick, very Buster Keaton about that moment. I always find it absolutely hilarious.
There's no music.
And the furniture looks something like some of the furniture looks like it should be from Clockwork Orange.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's also like those metal pipes that are just up.
Yeah.
And they just like knocks them over like dominoes. You know,
they're like giant
nuisance to live with.
They're like giant like silver toilet rolls. Yeah. That's what I always think.
It's that gaudy, slight late '60s, early '70s, isn't it?
Yeah, I wrote furniture looks like a pair of testicles.
Yeah.
There's definitely
or
something
coding.
Phallic going on.
Yeah.
As usual in Bond. Every other scene has a phallic image in Bond, let's
as
be honest.
He's kicked in the nuts, yeah. It's all linked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's some very unusual. I love the Trina Parks' noises, you know, when she's. we used to do impressions of it as kids. Like when she's all stiller. Do you know what I mean? When she's waiting for the next move and she's doing these amazing noises.
Yeah.
And then she's like, these screams as she runs towards Bond. And that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. You used to do.
We really did.
You used to do impressions of Trina Parks panting.
Yeah.
So you as a kid just going, and your mum and dad going,
What are you doing?
We're doing the impression of Bambi and Fox from James
Bond. Honest, mum and dad.
We were.
Honest, that's what we're doing.
I remember we were. I think, John, it was on some, I don't know whether it's Spring Harvest or something. Me and Matt and Harry were doing these noises as a joke. And then a lad next to us was like, what on earth are you doing? just being silly. You know, didn't have the guts to say, we're actually doing this female character from Diamonds Are Forever panting. Weird children.
That's one of the most amazingly queer
really
things
is,
I've ever heard. I love it. So a bunch of lads impersonating the noises that a female athlete is exerting while trying to accost James Bond.
Dear.
It's like
just
outed
Math and on this story.
Yeah.
Sadly, they can't back me. I'll take the brunt for this one, but yeah, it's always amused us that, and yeah, love it.
this whole scene when I rewatched this in preparation for this, I mean, the moon buggy sequence is kind of like where things get weird. And then my husband turned to me during this scene and just said, "This film just gets more and more bizarre."
Yeah.
Which I think nails it, really.
Imagine watching this. If you are new to Bond and you'd watched them in order so far, I know we've said that before, but what? Absolutely. You might be like, finally, here's one that's just a bit of a joke. I'm loving this. Brilliant.
And another toilet as well, because Willet White. You hear the flush of the toilet, and he steps out. FBI, CIA.
Is that an in-joke?
British intelligence.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like his office, even here, is the toilet. Yeah, no.
Yeah. I just finished the big deal.
Oh, shit. Yes, he was giving breaststroke lessons. Is that sexual?
Yeah.
No, Carl, that's just you. That is just you.
Come on, it is Dams Are Forever.
I thought it was Felix going like keeping the thousands. Yeah.
You straight people are so complicated. You've just got one track mind.
I think Tom Mankiewicz has got one track mind. Yeah. Oh dear. Oh, yeah, it's brilliant. So they're just left there, a bit like Blofeld is later, just left there, aren't they? Don't know what happened. Mm.
Hi, this is Anthony Stark. I played Truman Lodge in License to Kill, and you're listening to Really 007.
Right, we're nearly there now, aren't we? John's favourite quote of the film?
It's in my top five, yeah? Definitely.
Just this film or just the whole Bond series?
Of this film? I mean, this film's full of them, isn't it, really? You know, it's full of great quotes. I can't deny it. I mean, just before I say it, when he first comes out, and he looks around like he's free. Willard White looks around like he's enjoying seeing what isn't a particularly nice landscape, which makes me think that he's been held prisoner.
Yeah.
Another reason why I like it, as opposed to he's just enjoying it. But then obviously we got Bird Saxby. Tell us, <fine. laughs> which, whilst I love that line, brings up 101 problems. Absolutely no reason for Bert Sachs to be there and assassinate Willard White.
He has just told him on the phone, didn't he?
No, he's told James Bond.
Oh, right, yes, of course. Sorry, yeah.
He's told James Bond. So if
he has, how? Yeah.
So if Blofeld, there'd have been a point where Blofeld would have gone, otherwise we'd have seen a scene where, Bert, why have you not gone to kill Willard White? You've not told me. I've told you on the phone. You know, oh, right. James Bond must have got his quartermaster to bring over the contraption that he used for the children last year to sort it. Ah, that's what it is. I'll go and do the job.
I always assume that scene has happened, but that may be just because I love this film, so I kind of give it a free
deleted
pass.
Deleted scene, maybe?
But I sort of had... Yeah, I haven't seen that deleted scene, if it does exist, but I think it was... Yeah, I think it was more to do with the fact that that actor... his name's just gone out of my head, even though we've
Bruce
talked
Cabot.
About him. The Bruce Cabot, you know, they did want to keep him around to kind of keep paying him. So it was one of Cubby's kind of, I don't want to say charity case because that sounds unkind, but he did keep certain actors around longer than he needed to for that reason. So I think that's the reason that scene exists. But I approach every Bond film with the kind of philosophy that Raymond Chandler, I don't know if you've ever read any Raymond Chandler novels, like the Philip Marlowe series and that kind of thing. But in The Big Sleep, which is one of my favourite novels of all time, there's a character killed a couple of chapters in. You never find out why that character, you know, why that character died. And it was only after it went to publication, Raymond Chandler went, oh God, I forgot to explain who killed that character. But as you're reading that, and I've read that book at least three or four times, as you're reading it, you never really think, why did that character die?
Yeah.
For some reason, you just kind of move on. And I always get that with Bond films. They are somewhat incoherent if you try to, you know, even our beloved Dalton movies, if you try to explain the plot to somebody, you sound like an insane person because they make no sense.
No, it's true.
Especially the Living Daylights. It makes no sense whatsoever. Octopussy, no sense whatsoever. And so I think you just kind of live with that. I mean, as kids, surely none of us actually got these stories at all.
No, in any capacity.
Why is he there? Why has he been shot? Why is he an old man?
Yeah, who cares? You know, whatever.
You know, the death is pretty... Well, he gives himself away, doesn't he? He really exposes himself. Like, oh, he's had it, hasn't he?
It is a bit like a cowboy film.
Yeah, well, yeah.
More. It is, which is very appropriate, isn't it? Yeah.
Bartek?
Yeah.
I love it.
The actor wears a cowboy hat in real life as well. Willard White's the...
Couldn't you say
yeah,
that?
Yeah.
Wasn't he a singer?
Yes, in fact, right. Well, now we can talk. We haven't talked about him yet. Yeah, Jimmy Dean. Saltzman saw him in a presentation, a bit like Putter Smith. He saw him in the jazz concert. I mean, he was obviously knew that he wanted a Howard Hughes pastiche, but he didn't want it to be like a pastiche, and neither did Jimmy Dean didn't either, because apparently he was an employee of Howard Hughes's at the time in one of his hotels, the Desert Inn. So it was all a bit, what on earth are we doing here? We're just taking the mick out of our employer and our friend. But yeah. So Willard White, the actor Jimmy Dean, country singer, he got his big break into TV as a puppeteer for Jim Henson. I mean, how good are these people? Wow. So many different things going on. Does anyone know what successful company he had? A massive multi-million dollar business making sausages. Yeah. Yeah.
I did. I don't know why I knew that, but I did.
So there you go. It's all. Yeah. He's not really an actor, so what a performance! But whether you agree with that,
yeah, good. It's really good.
I've just put his name into Spotify, and there are so many albums on there. I know what I'm doing tomorrow.
Jimmy Dean Day. Yeah.
There's even a Spotify playlist, the This Is Jimmy Dean playlist. So someone has got at Spotify headquarters has got around to curating a playlist of the essential Jimmy Dean songs.
Excellent.
Do you know one of the only other acting gigs of his I could find? Yet again, an American TV series that, well, it's certainly linked to the next Bond film, but so many of them seem to have been in it.
A TV series?
Linked to... Oh, no, not the next one, sorry. The one after.
Give us a clue.
Well, what? The Man with the Golden Gun, who... Fantasy Island.
Ah, right.
Zipline, Zipline and all that, yeah.
I've never actually seen that.
They just know the quote.
Whenever anyone quotes that about... what's his name? I'm just like, I haven't seen that programme.
I think it was... Just means somebody's arriving on set. Somebody's arriving at the island. That's all it meant, I think. And he told, he told Scaramanga. I mean, whoever was his employee. But, yeah. Same thing. Well, that was done after the Man with the Golden Gun. There's a bit of toing and froing in this film in terms of location and timing and stuff. It gets a bit confusing and you try and remember what order it was all done in. So we do go back to the White House, don't we? Because then Q is on the slot machines. It's just like a... Mm-hmm. Because they need to get Tiffany captured, we'll just do it here, I don't know. But,
Hi there, Mr. King.
Yeah. How does she know who he is? Was she there before?
I don't know, yeah.
I don't care. But.
She's kind of had the sort of staff induction meeting by this point, I think. It's like, these are the who's who. So, I mean, let's leave to one side the fact that no one really knows who the heck's in charge at this point in the film. Is it the CIA? Yep. Why the hell are British intelligence so involved? I love that line to Willard White. It's like about, FBI, CIA, British intelligence. It's like, what jurisdiction?
Yeah.
It's absolutely, which is the same thing in the novel of Diamonds Forever. You just think, why the hell is James Bond even involved at this point?
What are you doing?
But I love any part of any Bond film where he says, I'm British intelligence, so I work for Her Majesty's government. I work for the British government. I work for the British government. And I never, I've done quite a lot of work for the Department for Education over the years. And I love when I go to one of those events saying, I work for the British government.
Jacket.
In a pink tie. Yeah, that's it, yeah. Put the mic on me. I work for the British government. I love it. But yeah, it's that. Presumably she's been introduced to all the personnel and all that sort of thing. She knows what's going on. She's on the side of good. It's all a bit weird. But again, I think
I think this film is quite elliptical in that you assume lots has happened in between these particular scenes.
She's very she gets personal with everyone, doesn't she? It's Mr. Q. She's the only person to ever call Blofeld Ernst.
Yeah,
you know, as well.
It's like we already talked about Tiffany in detail, but you know, there's so much more to that character than meets the eye sometimes. She's so personable to everyone. She's determined to do whatever it takes to survive. And that's why a lot of people don't get this scene, and we'll get to the drag bit in a moment. But I see it as Tiffany trying to show.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
A representative of MI6, one of the good guys, Q, that she's kind of on the straight and narrow by sort of trying to find out information about Blofeld and where he's going. So it is her trying to put her eggs in a particular basket, if that's the right phrase. But yeah, she's trying to show that she's redeeming herself.
Yeah, I like the idea of that, definitely. I think again, unfortunately, the issue I have with it is that she sees a drag queen with a cat and she thinks, oh my word, that's Blofeld. So we have to interpret that she's had that CIA down run of who they're actually after, because she's had no personal connection with Blofeld herself. So she's genuinely just going it off the fact that she sees a cat. Which, if you want to run with that, and it's again, it's a really minor quibble. I'm nitpicking. I'm not trying to, you know,
just done for the line, isn't it?
Have a go.
Look where the cat's dragging.
It's just, yeah, exactly.
She's good.
Yeah, I'm delighted to meet you, Miss Kate. You know, it's not.
I had so dreaded the prospect of making this tedious journey alone.
Yeah, he probably hates Vegas, doesn't he?
Oh God, he Blofeld is not a Vegas kind of person. No.
This version of Blofeld, the clone, the great. No, we don't. The multiverse with the Blofeld multiverse.
No, that's an idea.
Yeah, famous, yeah. But before she actually gets captured, yeah, Q with his electromagnetic ring, another gadget that is not, you know, to do with killing people or a weapon.
No, but it's crisp.
Yeah,
it's crisp. It'd be my top three gadgets what? I'd want.
Oh right, yeah.
Of course would. You know, absolute winner.
Winner every time.
As long as you have been... Exactly, yeah. Look at lady.
I love how you've gone for the top three gadgets, not a giant diamond-powered space laser.
No, no.
But something that helps you win at slot machines. Yeah. It's like...
Could have earned his money that way.
The level of ambition there is somewhat stifling.
As I said, David, I live an hour away from Blackpool. Every weekend to be fun. You know?
You know, we wouldn't even have to do any transplanting of our version of Diamonds Are Forever in Blackpool there. You know, you could just do that scene
it would work.
As it appears.
We've already had the elephant roaring. That's different. Yeah, that's a different scene, isn't it? This is just that's when the elephant wins on the slot machines, isn't it? You're meant to laugh at how ridiculous. Anyway, yeah, this is this is Q's turn to win big on the slot machine.
Tom, we're far too into Diamonds of Forever to find that sort of thing amusing.
Yeah, if you just walked in and, yeah, we're just talking about Bond. Sorry, I thought you were just talking about an elephant roaring when they won on the slot machines. Like, yeah? What's what? That's Bond. I think so.
Maybe after a strong drink.
Elephants, of course, in Octopussy. They're doing the acrobatics at the end to get into her own house. Tiffany has been kidnapped, effectively. But no violence or... She just walked into the car. That's it. It's fine.
Well, she's sort of shoved into the car, isn't she? Yeah, she is.
Who by?
I presume the driver of the car. Mm. I mean, you know, the elephant in the room. Sorry, another elephant. The elephant in the room is the... Is Blofeld drag. And again, it's one of those moments which it's sort of ridiculous and you sort of have to have a weird brain like mine to kind of find this logical that Blofeld would do this to escape the building he's in. And I sort of give it a pass on the logic front sort of thing. But I do... I don't know. How do you guys take the Blofeld in drag thing? It's weird, obviously. It's like... it doesn't really seem to fit in some ways, but it does in others.
I think there is some logic behind it. It's like no one's going to be looking for a woman, and I also think if it worked for Kurt Russell in Tango and Cash, he gets away with, doesn't he? There's a scene in Tango and Cash where he escapes dressed in drag, and I think it's quite a common thing, isn't it? It's like kind of looking out for a man, so therefore you dress as a woman, because then, in the same way that Stacey puts her cap on and wears a very form-fitting boiler suit when she's mind, no one's going to look at, that's clearly a man, she's dressed as a man, it's that kind of logic. But to me, it kind of makes sense. He could walk through the casino and no one would bat an eyelid because he looks like a...
6'3".
The thing, isn't it? The more I've recently spent quite a long time looking particularly at the Charles Grey Blofeld character and going through the film like in painstaking detail. It's not...
Nauseating.
I'm not even sure it's drag... In nauseating detail. I'm not even sure it's drag...
No, I'm just going to say
in
that.
In kind of any conventional drag, sense.
It's just a disguise as a woman.
He's just dressed as a woman.
He's not doing acts.
Well, I mean, leaving aside the whole, what counts as men's and women's clothing, performance, whatever, it's a blue trouser suit. And essentially, which obviously women can wear trouser suits, but it's quite, masculine in that sense. Obviously, there are frilly cuffs on the shirt. I've got the picture in front of me now, so I'm just double checking the details.
The colours.
And it's a really not very good blonde wig. And really slapdash makeup. I think most drag queens wouldn't be seen dead in that sort of get-up. It's terrible in terms of, what counts as drag, at least in kind of an American tradition, and this is a whole other discussion for another time. But, perhaps it's that kind of, it's that British comedic pantomime dame kind of appearance rather than a drag performance, I think.
Yeah, because he's got the same voice, doesn't he? He's not putting on an act.
He's not trying to emulate a woman, and he's also not kind of trying to exaggerate a woman, which is what drag essentially is, from my fairly limited knowledge of it. So it's sort of, it is just a little bit anomalous, but I just find it incredibly fun. I especially love the way that he takes his glasses off and moves the hair to one side. Like he is imitating a woman. So even though his appearance isn't particularly feminine, the mannerisms are quite feminine, and he really leans quite heavily into that.
What makes you think this was my first time?
I have no problem with it.
I have
no problem with it. My thing with Bond films is tone, and I'm very much the kind of person who's, if you choose a tone for a film, go full in with that film. And in fairness to Diamonds Are Forever, it chooses a tone, and I'll always accept it that it sticks consistently to that tone. I find it more grating and I know I go on about this all the time, but I find it more grating the Blofeld performance in For Your Eyes Only, which is a serious film, and we're talking about a serious subject, and then we have a really silly death with him begging to buy a, what is it, delicatessen in stainless steel or something.
It started so serious, but visiting his wife's grave.
After it started with him about his wife, that to me is far more out of place than Blofeld dressing as a woman to escape in Diamonds Are Forever, because it is only consistent with what we've been seeing already. So I am absolutely fine with it. I've not got a problem with it at all.
You think it gets bunched up, you know, the silly one, he went to space, and then he would, the one with Bond's a clown, and the one with Blofeld in drag, it's silly, you know. Hang on, it's not that simple, you know.
100%. And I think there is I don't know what it is, but there is that sort of hatred amongst us, a particular, you know, section of the Bond community of the campier elements. They use it in terms of they use it as a disparaging term, really, even though it's been there since right beginning, even in the novels, not even just when Dr. No, the film started. And it's been there, and I really, in a sense, feel sorry for those fans if they can't embrace the sillier, if you want to call them, elements. Because what are they going to be striving for? They're going to always be striving for, I mean, all four of us love License to Kill because it is one of the harder films. That's not the reason we love it. We love License to Kill. Yes, it's widely considered one of the harder films, but that film has so many silly elements to it.
Absolutely.
And people, I think, are very selective, and especially when you read those really awful clickbaity pieces on things like Screen Rant and whatever, and they go for the low-hanging fruit of, you know, the same kind of opinions trotted out again and again.
So boring.
Roger Moore dresses as a clown in Octopussy. Mm-hmm. Blofeld dresses in drag in Diamonds Are Forever. And it's that kind of same stuff again and again and again.
Yeah.
Written usually by people who, not like us, you know, those people, you know, probably are just, you know, they've seen those films once and they're just trotting out other people's opinions. And I get really worried that sometimes fans in the Bond community just think like they have to conform to those traditional points of view rather than actually, you know, being bold enough to have an original thought about it themselves.
They'd done the research, they would have said, well, how silly is this? He's dressed as a gorilla, and he's Tarzan in that film. Don't just say the clown, you know.
Yeah,
you've got more to go on if you've actually watched it. But you'd know that they all work.
I mean, and the thing is, the drag scene is so, if you can believe it's drag, but the drag scare quote scene, the drag scene is so short.
It really is.
It's literally just almost like about 11 seconds of screen time. And so much has been poured over. And I've done my fair amount of poring over that as well because of its implications. But let's be honest, it probably was something that it may not have even been scripted. And on the set, it was, in Diamonds Forever, it does have that freeform sort of feel.
Mm. Loads of wigs hanging out.
You know what? Let's just have Charles put on a wig, some really slapdash makeup, and that's how he gets out. Yeah. That's how we solve this plot problem.
Yeah.
Sorted.
That's how Tiffany recognized. Maybe she recognized the wig, given that she's got so many.
Yeah.
She spotted the wig before she spotted Blofeld.
Yeah.
Nice.
Well, that's
she
that's
wanted
what
to
I
know
got.
Where they got it from.
Look what the wig dragged in, is what he should have said. We go back to another location then. We go back to the laboratory. It's not laboratory, sir. It's oratory. No, that's the other way around.
Wrong film.
Yeah. Bond's now in another underrated suit, brown suits and a polo neck. Again,
Oh my God. I need that jacket in my life.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I've
sort of got a suit that sort of looks like that from Next a while ago, but I haven't quite got it. That jacket is incredible. I want it.
It's complemented by the polo neck.
Yeah, the polo neck.
Yes.
Oh, I'm not sure I'd go as far as the polo.
Oh, you
I'm not sure I can pull off a polo.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, the polar neck's awesome.
Come on. No.
I've never owned a polo neck, so no.
Tan knit.
Yeah.
Lovely.
I wore one on a night out, grey one once.
Yeah.
Equal parts abuse and praise. It's just quite uncomfortable.
Same people.
Yeah. Jennifer likes it.
Is it?
Yeah, it's just a bit.
Do you have to make sure you're quite clean shaven?
Yes, probably. Yeah.
Caught
your hairs.
Quite, yeah.
This is very Partridge again. Sorry. Right. Tom,
did you stick the Lynx Africa rubber ball through the top bit of the neck?
Trap the hairs, yeah. So Bond's in this lovely outfit. He's with Felix and Willard White. He's basically a bit like Moonraker. Again, that's later, of course. Going back to the laboratory to show what was going on, where he's already had an encounter. I do love that scene because it's all, I've never been so embarrassed in my life. But then M backs him, doesn't he, after that, which is cool. But yeah. But this, Shane Rimmer appears. I'd forgotten he was in this film.
Yeah.
Mr. Yank in Britain, yeah.
Oh, I just love him. So good.
Yeah. I don't think he was credited. So just happened to be there one day.
I wonder as well. I think there's one of the, and I'm just guessing because I know his voice from Thunderbirds, so I'm used to hearing his voice without looking at him as a person. There's one of the FBI agents who isn't him, but very much sounds like him when he speaks later on to Felix, and I wonder if
if he was a stuntman or something. Yeah. So much dubbing. We'll have to do an episode on that, won't we? I think it's getting out of hand there. He's gone here to show them tried to and unfoil the plot and find out what Blofeld's done, I assume. To try and find out what Blofeld's up to and his plans.
Piece it together.
So the scientist control has been overridden. The first one of another famous Barry Q. We've got this diamond satellite. So it's like, right, okay. But I mean, it's a bit silly, isn't it? But who cares?
I love the way the music cue fits with the. It's perfectly synchronized with the unveiling of the. It's the like what? There is something weirdly sexual going on with that. Let's be honest. I'm never quite sure what it is, but it was just like this feels a little bit uncomfortable.
It's the glowing red.
And then it attacks all these phallic symbols. I'm not sure if the satellite is supposed to be vaginal or what. I'm not sure what's going on, or if it is supposed to be another phallic symbol, but it attacks the really glowing red missile.
And then it attacks the
bulbous Russian submarine. And then
it's like A-level
English. And then there's the
Dr. Holland.
There's the row of rockets, which we presume, I think, are in China. And then, basically, it's that. I'm not going to get graphic, obviously, you know, family audience and all that. But there's a lot.
Except for Jazz Law, already. They've gone. We've lost.
Well, I know, but I you said for Jazz
Law.
I've said it now.
I apologise. Anyone listening from church, I don't know what one is. It's a complete
But
sorry, Dave. Go.
I found particularly when I was looking at You Only Live Twice, which it's very similar to You Only Live Twice in a lot of ways, because it's basically about the world powers, kind of exactly. For those listening at home, Tommy's with his fingers.
Oh, hey.
Miming, thank God you can't see this at home, listeners. Tommy's miming what happens to the space capsule being swallowed by the pronged space Blofeld device. But yeah, I mean, there is actually, I can't even get through this.
Children like.
I'm going to try and bring this back to an academic discussion here, but basically, long story short, there is a lot of academic research into how a lot of the language around Cold War weapons is basically thinly veiled penis metaphors.
And I've got to be honest, most of the academics who have written about this are women.
Mm.
So they have, I particularly explored this when I did my You Only Live Twice piece, but basically that they noted, especially in the 1980s, when there was a proliferation of nuclear weapons, they noted that all of the discourse, and this definitely carried on with Trump as well, talking about the size of his button and all that sort of stuff. It's so basically a load of men who are trying to outmeasure each other. And I think this scene is so good because it takes all that and it distills it into this amazing sequence where basically it shows how ridiculous the whole situation of the Cold War is.
Wow.
I think it's so clever.
Wow. Never thought about that before. I've just thought about that famous meme of the Chinese or Korean soldier that seems to go around, his screams and...
I'm never sure if it is Chinese or Korean.
Yeah,
soldier,
I didn't know either.
Actually, I've written Chinese in pieces because I've just assumed because of the world powers at that point.
Yeah, because Korea would be the US, wouldn't it?
He makes either Blofeld or Metz makes a line when they're discussing what they've done about what they've set off in Red China.
Okay, right.
Ah, there we go then. That's there right then, yeah.
Red, yeah. Well, it's, glowing tribute. It's all linked.
Which then gets us to the line. I'm not sure we're there yet, but calm yourself. Yeah. No, we're not there yet. This farcical show of force was only to be expected.
Yeah.
We'll get there in a bit, yeah.
That's the first time we hear about... Is it the same plot as Man with the Golden Gun? Is it used to be used for solar power? I don't really know what the...
No, it's the well, isn't it? So the Metz he thinks that he's teaming up with Blofeld to destroy nuclear weapons.
Yes,
which will then
actually
end...
Blofeld. Yes, yeah. The arms race. Blofeld is there to just basically get money out of world powers as well as get a bit of power at the same time.
Yes, it's dead simple. Never understood it until you told me. Thanks, Chris.
But Blofeld's plan is sort of incidental in a way. It happens off stage. It's like one of those great moments in a Shakespeare play where you can tell Shakespeare's not interested in the plot at all.
Yeah, again,
he's just interested in the characters, and it's just reported. Yeah. And so Willard White walks in and tells Bond what Blofeld's plot is, and Bond's sort of bemused by the idea rather than taking it terribly seriously. So that's the old, you know, he says something like to the effect of, oh, that old scheme sort of thing. And he just dismisses it. And it's like, this is not what this film is really about.
What do you think it's really about, David?
Oh, I don't know. It's you know, it's so deep. we cannot possibly plumb those depths in the 79 hours of this podcast.
If we ever get there... Before they do get to the oil rig, though, there's like another sort of scene working out the plot with Willard White, who gets quite a few lines,
mm-hmm.
and another famous line which we use for the quiz, of course. That's how it ends. John, do you want to? Woke our listeners
up. I'm obsessed that line. Oh yeah, I'm obsessed that, you know, they're discussing world terrorism basically going on and people blowing up things, and Willard White is just still loving his freedom, where it's time to just lie down full flat on this couch while he's discussing it. It's like, you know, I can't sit on the toilet locked up under that place all the time. It's time to stretch those legs.
So much characterization in this film.
It's deep.
Q's ties, yeah.
It's crisp and deep.
Right. So, yeah, the oil rig scene was shot, obviously an actual oil rig, off the shore of Oceanside in California. So it's all, where it would have been set, pretty much. I was thinking, what an amazing... on paper, it's incredible how they did it, and just to think of an actual whole oil rig set. Like, you know, did they have to get helicopters, I think, to get there every day? And it's an absolutely massive task to film something there.
I think for... I might... Yeah.
The exterior.
The oil rig, for me, is so disappointing. That's what I was underwhelming. Yeah.
On paper,
it's just great. Every time I watch it, just as soon as we get to the oil rig, I'm like, it feels like they've run out of budget. It's like, we'll just shoot it here. We're out at the sea, so we don't have to worry about, you know, the public and anything else, kind of, you know, kind of get, you know, any sort of interruptions or anything like that. We can just shoot it all. Then we'll get Ken to build the set. We'll do the interiors there.
Yeah.
It just seems, it just has that kind of, we've run out of cash vibe. And it's an oil rig. It's like, an oil rig that's also goes under the water. Can it not be an oil, you know, can it not be something?
Yeah, Stromberg.
It feels like we've run out of imagination here, and it could have been, I don't know, just something a bit more interesting anywhere. You play the scene out, but just an oil rig.
Nice uniforms, though.
They're a bit Iron Brew.
Yeah.
Very good.
Urn Brew. Yeah. Can't believe it's spelled IRL. Yeah, most of it is, you're right, is in the set, isn't it? Blofeld's in his office, listening to events, and Metz just comes in, announcing that the submarines are on standby to attack. And David, one of your favourite lines?
Oh, hang on, let's do the whole thing. Hey, let's get it right.
Get it right.
This is the big moment. Calm yourself, Metz. This farcical show of force was only to be expected. The great powers flexing their military muscles like so many impotent beach boys.
Yes!
Very good. Very good.
But it is almost sort of thrown away.
Yeah.
As they walk across his office after putting the cat down. So he's fussing the cat at the desk, and then, you know, responsible pet owner, Blofeld. Then he puts the cat down, and then he walks into the kind of control area sort of thing. So it's not like it's not like that line gets a moment to shine.
No.
But I honestly think that line is harking back to what we said a few minutes ago about the Cold War pretensions and the measuring contest. Yeah. It just encapsulates that so well, because that's exactly, you know, I get images of Venice Beach in California where you've got all these, you know, people pumping iron and showing off and that kind of thing. But he's kind of pointing out that, you know, these world powers are essentially just trying to outdo each other, and ultimately they've not got any metal, really.
METTLE. Yeah.
That's the one.
You're like,
they've not got any metal, though they have plenty of metal. METAL. Sorry, that's only very Partridge.
It did. Yeah. You're like boys with toys. Similar boys concept to that, isn't it?
It is exactly that. Yeah.
Running themes for the essays. Yeah.
Well, that goes back to, you know, Dr. No. Essentially, he's trying to topple. I can't wait to get around to Dr. No. I haven't done the queer review of that one at the time of this recording, but you know, essentially Dr. No is playing around with America's and Russia's missiles. I mean, for God's sake, you know, it's not even symbolism by that point, is it? Let's be honest.
John's face again.
I have a horrible feeling, John, that I've completely tainted these films forever.
Well, mate, you know, as I've highlighted all the plot holes in this film, all I'll say is that you've most certainly got your revenge, because every time I'm going to just see any kind of missile in any film now, I'm just going to go, Willy.
Yeah, yeah.
that is exactly what they are, though, isn't it?
Well, Austin Let's Powers, be honest. I guess.
The giant drill,
Well,
you know the map on the Spy Love Me. You see them, don't you? Going into the
The
submarines. Yeah,
yeah. 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 Let's move on.
Oh gosh, yeah, we're on the oil rig, aren't we? We've had that line, which should have had a bit more prevalence. Really, the blue outfits, the orange helmets and boots, like we say, Iron Brew. A plane then drops this parachute containing an inflatable silver bag. It looks beautiful, but I don't know how it floats ashore. There's no shore, is there?
He goes zorbing.
Is that what he's doing?
Okay. It does look like it's turning.
It's got like. Yeah, so as he walks inside it, he
another gadget.
Yeah. He's walking towards you.
I love the dialogue.
Break a sweat either.
No.
I love the dialogue as he steps out.
Yeah.
Acme, what is it about the Acme? He just plays up to it. Honestly, Connery is so good in this film. I will never understand why anyone criticizes Connery in this film, because he sells everything, every single moment. And there's that amazing shot as he actually has the Zorb unzipped and he peeks out and he doesn't look scared or anything. It's just like, I'm just gonna own this.
Is it
it's
a three
so
piece
good.
Suit? You know, just saying how practical clothing.
I know.
What do you think? You should have been the sort of man from the milk tray outfit, or that would be a bit more practical, wouldn't it?
No, I think it's just so fitting that he's wearing an immaculately tailored suit. It has to, and you know, Blofeld references it in a bit as well.
But isn't it deliberate as well? Because hasn't he hidden the tape in the shoulder?
Yes.
Ooh, all makes sense. This
That's why they unstitch it there to put, because he's hidden the tape in the shoulder, because I think they make a reference to it.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. It's a pity to have ruined the line of your suit.
Yeah.
We get a bit of the Bond theme used. He's pretending to be a pollution inspector, but he knows that they know who he is. That's right.
Yeah.
He's not expecting.
Totally. Yeah. No.
We go in the crane lift. And he then spots Tiffany sunbathing in another very famous bikini, but with like that sort of. I don't know whether she's got the top part. Is that later when she gets the sort of add on?
Later,
perhaps.
You've missed. Go on. Sorry, Tom, we've actually missed one of these infinitesimal details. But you've missed one of Blofeld's. One of my favourite shades of his.
Oh.
How disappointing. I was expecting one head of state at the very least.
Yes.
Surely you haven't come to negotiate, Mr. Bond. Your pitiful little island hasn't even been threatened.
Yeah.
It's that national pride kind of Bond representing, you know, this whole film, Bond is just about hanging on to any kind of preeminence, any kind of importance of the British Empire at this point. And Blofeld just decides to hit him where it hurts by saying, "Why are you here?"
It's right, isn't it? Why is he there?
Yeah.
No. but it doesn't. It's like he's annoyed that he's there, but then he isn't annoyed, is he? He's like, "Oh, he keeps cropping up." But
he's really happy to have him there because he can explain his plan to him.
Exactly.
He's got an audience.
He's already told Metz many times. Does Metz know the plot? Who knows? I don't.
Poor Metz.
Yeah, poor Metz.
Like, one of the most genius... It's very true, that, isn't it, though? Like, you find those academic genius people who don't see the blatantly obvious either, don't they?
Yeah. The evil plans. Yeah.
Very well written.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
Does Tiffany see Bond? I can't remember. He sees her. But...
Yeah, there. She pulls the shades down, doesn't she? And
more shades. Then,
yeah, there's more shades.
When is it he calls her?
Call her Dragon Lady.
Dragon Lady, yeah.
Really what is going
Dragon
on?
Dragon Lady. Couldn't believe that.
Weird, so weird. I love it.
Jealousy from you, Mr. Bond. I'm flattered.
Yeah, another one. But it's the Guy Hamilton finale, woman in a bikini. You know, the diamonds are forever. Live and Let Die, we get obviously Rosie in the bikini. And then Man with the Golden Gun.
You know what? I've never noticed, and this is such a gay thing to say, but I've never noticed all the bikinis in Guy Hamilton's movies.
Because Brit Eklund didn't like this.
And that's why we notice the bikinis, and that's you notice the missiles.
David was noticing it from a political allegory. Nothing sexual.
Exactly. I was approaching it from a psychological... Yeah. No, I'm just lying to myself at this point. Yeah.
I'm only joshing, man.
Blofeld is actually listening to the cassette. I so hate Marshall music. So good.
I do so hate Marshall music.
Again, backstory of military school, you never know. I don't know.
But it ties in with that theme of him having utter disdain for the... I always get the feeling that Blofeld... sits above all the geopolitics going on at the time, and he just sees the game for what it is. He sees the penis measuring contest. he sees all of that and goes, okay, I'm just going to mess with that. I'm just going to exploit it.
Another reason why I have my revisionist view that this is before Majesties is he comes out with this line that science was never my strong.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it's like the previous film, you were creating...
A scientist, yeah.
You were creating viruses for pandemics around the world. You know, it's just there's a lack of consistency there. But
it's not within the same film, so that's crucial, John.
Not within the same film, spot on. Yeah. I agree with that. Yeah.
It's also a very neat scripting thing. Science was never my strong suit, but, you know, cut to the chase. We don't need to know the ins and
exactly,
outs.
Exactly, yeah.
Just give us the everyman version.
That cassette actually contains the master satellite control tape, for some reason, anyway. Well, we know why it is, so we get the scene later. But so he assumes Bond wanted to swap it. Can someone sort of do a Calvin Dyson with the Fabergé egg and just explain the whole, you know, process of the eggs and sorry the cassette. when is it real? Which is the wrong one? And who and what order does it go in to swap it? And then she puts it in the wrong. Does she mean to take the wrong one out, or does she take the wrong?
Doesn't she? Yeah.
Bond slots into her bikini bottoms. God, I never thought I'd say that sentence. Bond slots into her bikini bottoms the fake cassette. That's correct, isn't it? To dispose of it.
Yeah.
No, the real cassette. One. The real cassette. That's
puts it.
It
back.
That's yeah. it. And yeah. she... So Bond manages to do the sleight of hand to swap the fake cassette into the deck, and then he slots the real cassette into her bikini bottoms.
So did Bond intend that to happen, though? No, or does she muck it up?
I think he gets cross with her. He gets
But is he double bluffing?
Yeah, he gets really.
Doesn't he call her a twit?
Yeah, those are stupid.
Yeah. stupid twit.
But the scene that's not very where nice. Bond presses the button and the tape fires out, and he turns and looks at Blofeld.
Yeah,
he's absolutely brilliant.
Suddenly, Harry looks like some Mr. Bond.
Yeah,
Mr. Boy. He's like, oops. It's so good that look that Connery gives him is.
Yeah, it's like a naughty 5 year old.
Yeah,
that's exactly brilliant. What it is.
I think that actually the real tape stays until the end. Then, so I think that the end
it does.
And it's only because the oil rig's destroyed as opposed to the tape being taken out that's why the mission is successful. Yeah.
Well, the film just cuts then. We don't know what happens, but we'll get to that.
Well, there is that, but yeah.
obviously, Charles Gray was thinking, Guy, come on, there's no reason why she's still in a bikini. So Blofeld then suggests she puts me on so the audience aren't distracted. That's what happens. He says, yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
But her idea of putting something on's amazing. Yeah.
But don't cover your bottom half because we need to see that later on the joke. Yeah.
The line is, I'd put something on over that bikini first, my dear.
Yeah.
I've come too far to have the aim of my crew affected by the sight of a pretty body.
Yeah.
Which is... You know, he's not finding... You've got a question, why is she sitting there in a bikini? There is absolutely no hint that Blofeld is into her.
Like Scaramanga, though.
Yeah, so she's...
It's just Guy Hamilton.
...in a bikini, just... Yeah, it's Guy Hamilton. It's for the audience, let's be honest.
Yeah.
But I was...
I was putting it down, so she doesn't have any concealed weapons or anything like that.
Yeah, true.
That's what I always thought. Particularly for the man with a golden gun.
Yeah.
Yeah, he does in Man with a Golden Gun, yeah. Any excuse.
Yeah. You won't... It's saying to the lads, you won't go home empty-handed. Another Partridge reference. Okay. Did anyone remember what the sign said on the wall?
If in doubt.
Brilliant. That's got to be a, you know, Wizard of Ice level question.
Which is a great... From a, you know, from an HR standpoint, is, you know, it's pretty progressive.
Yeah. What is this film? What on earth? Like, what the decision? Yeah, let's have that. So good.
The aesthetic of this sequence, the whole finale, is like ripped wholesale in Austin Powers.
Yeah.
It's that got that kind of mundane sort of, you know, this is a real organisation, but it's, but they're also really evil.
Yeah.
And that's why I love that sign, because it is just like,
that's what would be on the wall of the oil rig. You know, they haven't bothered taking that down.
And a little dig. If we destroy Kansas, the world may not hear about it for years. A little dig there, you know, the sort of Midwest country, you know. It's like, you're right, he's just throwing shade, isn't he? Yeah, describes New York as all smut and
there
traffic.
There is one you've... Sorry, I did actually literally... I'm so sad, I transcribed every bloke line from this film when I was doing my piece about this recently. And the one that you've gone past, which is the one which apparently Cubby Broccoli hated, and he was like, this line is just not going to go over well. And it was, as La Rochefoucauld observed, humility is the worst form of conceit. I do hold the winning hand. And that's Cubby was like, no one's going to get that reference. But the whole point is that you don't get that reference. It's like, so La Rochefoucauld, I read far too much about this. La Rochefoucauld was a 17th century French nobleman. And he basically wrote this book of about 500 kind of aphorisms, like short, wise kind of sayings, sort of thing. He didn't actually say that one, incidentally, but long story short, no, I didn't know this until fairly recently myself, but I've always loved that line because it's just like, Blofeld's that sort of person who's going to be a know-it-all in any situation and he's trying to impress Bond. I know it's been a tradition since Dr. No to have the villain seduce Bond in the sense of trying to win him over to that kind of side. But it's him, you know, Bond's a know-it-all anyway, which we've established early on in this film.
1860.
But Blofeld's trying to say, I know even more than you. That's what he's doing here. You don't need to know who La Rochefoucauld was. I've spent, spent 30 years not knowing who that was and only found out fairly recently. So it doesn't matter. But there you go.
Very good. Well, thank you for the research, David. Yeah.
Well, thank you. There's that fascinating footnote about a 17th century French nobleman.
That's Dave.
Which God knows where Tom Mankiewicz got it from. But, you know.
Yeah, he explains the plot. All satellites are controlled by a coded tape.
We haven't shown enough cheek.
No, we haven't shown enough cheek, but John mentioned it earlier, Hi Ernst, and then is Superman giving you any trouble? So another
Superman giving you any trouble.
Superman 3, yeah.
It's brilliant.
I'm Diamonds Are Forever. Yeah, Bikini Bottoms. Your problems are all behind you now. Yeah. Quite babyish again, Bond tying his shoelaces, distracting the guards by setting off the red balloon. Is that symbolic, or is that a euphemism? Going for every
Tom,
single...
Tom, again, I think that's just you again, Tom.
I really struggle with the next 5 minutes, I've got to say.
You stupid twit, yeah.
Sorry, Chris. No, have you got something to say, Chris?
No, I want to hear.
Yeah, do you want me to fire your bullet?
Shoot him!
Right. He's tying his shoelace. He lets a balloon off. Gunman shoots it. He pushes a guy with a gun out of the way where he's completely unarmed. He then decides he gets two people stop him, hold him up. He walks off. They've got guns in their hand. He throws them to one side. And it's like, and it's all done with no intensity, at a slow rate. There's no music going on. And then you get a few fired shots. And ultimately, the premise of the film is that this is only defeated because the oil rig is destroyed. It's nothing to do with the tape. And the reason why is because there's a pathetic line of defense. He says, fire the cannons or whatever. And they have this really rubbish gun that they're firing from, where the helicopters just destroy straight away. So if they was holding a world to ransom and they'd have found out that it was there, there's such a lack of protection that this is over in seconds and it's just played for laughs. And I know that the film is predominantly played for laughs, but what we have had throughout the film is we've had mystery. We've had something leading up to what the plot is. And then when we get to the final, it's very anticlimactic. I'm sorry, that is just, it's my opinion, and I'm sorry about that. Because I like so much of this film, but I do agree with Chris when he said that I find that the oil rig lacks budget. I think that's the best way to describe it. It's an afterthought. That's how I see it.
Yeah, you're right. I always saw the bit, like you say, where Bond just sort of like swats them away, doesn't it? It's like you say, played for laughs and kind of, you know, there's no threat. But also, like, Bond isn't bothered. He feels like he's like, no one's going to touch him, because I think that's maybe like, he knows the guards wouldn't kill him because Blofeld wants him. Yeah. You know, he's going to whatever.
Yeah, right.
But it is a kind of.
All makes sense.
Yeah, I just feel that this final scene is not just lacking the sort of the on screen kind of, you know,
jeopardy.
And also that the screenplay's kind of run out of steam as well. You know, there's a couple of good lines, but it's just basically right. How do we get this thing to explode? And cut to this, and that's such a shame because. Having watched it again, I really appreciate that the dialogue and the some of the characters are so well drawn and observed, and the dialogue is really cutting, which I'd never really noticed until seeing it recently. I hadn't realised just how well written the dialogue is, and also to see Tiffany Case just become. Just not the like she's been lobotomized. She was this.
If only they
really
were brains.
Great, sassy, you know. And then she's just like, it's such a waste because up to there, I think she's a really great character.
I agree with everything you've said, even though, you know, I'm probably one of the world's biggest fans of this film. I agree that the tension goes out of the movie at this point when Bond has become tiresome. You know, even locking him up in the brig, which actually, to be honest, Blofeld does also do in Honor Majesty's Secret Service, but midway through the film, does not feel sufficiently tense. And it's almost like you are sort of waiting for the film to play itself out. I mean, for me, the most frustrating thing about the finale is exactly as you've identified, Tiffany's loss of agency, which is what happens in The Man with the Golden Gun as well. Everyone thinks Mary Good, again, one of those really awkward kind of conventional opinions is that Mary Goodnight is completely ineffective.
Absolutely.
Actually, for at least two-thirds of the movie, and definitely the first third of the movie, she's really good, and she's well ahead of Bond. She knows more than him. And then in the end, I mean, I know that her rear end is responsible for a lot of the jeopardy of the finale, but it's like, and it is a Bond trope that still exists now. If you think of Spectre, I find it intensely irritating that Madeline Swan does not pick up a gun in the finale to Spectre. Oh. I just find it so irritating. Not even like the end of the second act. And, even my beloved Tomorrow Never Dies, Michelle Yeoh does sort of lose her agency in the final stage as well.
Yeah, she does. Sorry, David, go on.
No, go on, go.
Well, I was just going to say on the Goodnight thing as well. I mean, I heard this somewhere else, but someone was saying that everyone goes on about, Goodnight blows the place up by her backside. She pushes Crow in there and he says, you stupid girl, and that causes the reaction. But it's only the same way that Bond kills Dr. No.
Yeah.
And
Goldfinger tripping over the
write it.
The bomb.
And they don't write it that because Bond does it, therefore the whole place blows up and everyone's in jeopardy. But when Goodnight does it, it comes across as, you stupid girl, what have you done? Roger is very dismissive. Yeah. And it's sad. It's sad that that's written like that because it doesn't need to be like that. It's unfair. Really, Douglas.
In our final part of our Diamonds Are Forever review, Bond sees off Blofeld, Wint and Kidd before we assess the critical and box office reception of the film.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.